You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with US political historian Dr. James Boyes. Good morning, James. What have you got for us?
Well, this morning we're going to be talking about enforcing gun laws in the US, American problems in the Middle East, and Mayor Bloomberg's legacy projects in New York.
More from James in just a few moments' time. But also on the programme, France requests more European military support for the Central African Republic. We'll ask if more boots on the ground will help or hinder.
We'll also get the news from Jerusalem, where storms, both political and physical, have been battering the West Bank.
And crossing to Paris, our correspondent pops down to a retrospective exhibiting 600 of Cartier's most important designs.
It shows that a house of jewelry has a specific style since its very beginning, and it's very distinctive and probably not as well known as for other artists.
All that, plus we play some fantastic music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But before all that, let's catch up with the latest world news from David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. North Korea has marked the two-year anniversary of the death of former leader Kim Jong-il. Images from Pyongyang showed a hall with ranks of military personnel in front of a huge picture of the late leader. Sat at the front of the ceremony was his son Kim Jong-un, who inherited the leadership after his death in 2011. Last week, he presided over the execution of Chan Song-taek, his uncle, and a powerful figure seen by outside observers as his mentor. A judge in the United States has ruled the mass collection of telephone data by the country's main spy agency unconstitutional. The operations of the National Security Agency were described as an arbitrary invasion. The NSA's collection of data, including phone numbers and the times and dates of calls, was highlighted by Edward Snowden. Meanwhile, the White House has rejected reports he could be given an amnesty if he stops leaking secrets. Spokesman Jay Carney says their position hasn't changed.
He has been charged and accused of leaking classified information. He faces felony charges here. He ought to be returned to the United States, again, where he will face full due process and protection under our system of justice.
The leaders of Russia and Ukraine will meet later to discuss possible loans to help ease an economic crisis that has seen huge anti-government protests in Kiev. The demonstrations were sparked after Ukraine rejected an EU trade deal, with President Yanukovych saying he'd come under intense pressure from Moscow not to sign the agreement. The UN Secretary-General is calling for a ceasefire in Syria's civil war ahead of planned peace talks next month. Ban Ki-moon says the humanitarian crisis around the fighting is getting worse as winter approaches. And weeks away from negotiations in Geneva, he says both sides should stop the fighting to give the talks a chance to succeed.
2013 was the year in which the Syrian conflict deteriorated beyond all imagination. The people of Syria cannot afford another year, another month, even another day of brutality and destruction. That we must have cessation of hostilities before we begin political dialogue.
Britain should consider building new runways at London's Heathrow and Gatwick airports, a government commission has said. The Airport Commission has issued a shortlist of expansion options, saying it would also undertake a further study of another option to build a new airport in the Thames Estuary to the east of London. The commission, set up by the government last year, is tasked with making its final proposals on how and where to expand UK airport capacity by the summer of 2015. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David Spencer. David will be back at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Hong Kong,
Zurich, London, London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vas a Monocle, vas a City Check.
London.
London. London.
から.
De Londres.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
It's time to set the day's agenda with a look at some of the top stories for the next 24 hours. Joining us to do so is Dr. James Boyes, American political historian. Welcome back to the studio, James. Let's start off with recent events. There was a shooting at a school in Colorado last Friday. So the focus has now returned to gun laws, and now it's their enforcement.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only was there a shooting last week, but of course we've just recognised the first year anniversary of the Sandy Hook killings. And one of the great problems with this, I think, is that all too often the focus is upon Washington, D.C. and the inability of politicians to get anything done, it would seem, and whether one blames the president for that and his inability to push forward a very strong series of gun control legislation, or whether one blames the NRA for supporting Republicans. One of the problems, however, is actually with enforcement, because we have a situation whereby local sheriffs on the ground are now saying, well, actually, they don't recognise any efforts to try and impose gun control legislation as being constitutional.
So what happens then? How irrelevant and meaningless are what were considered quite a tough package of gun control?
Well, this is the great thing. We can look at various elements that are being brought into place at local state level. So in New York, for example, Governor Cuomo has signed off some of the toughest gun legislation in the country. But when you have individual sheriffs on the ground who are saying, hang about a second, there's a challenge here because the Constitution says Americans have the right to bear arms, but you are imposing upon us laws which appear to contravene that. The Constitution is, of course, the highest law in the land. So the sheriffs are saying, with some justification, although it is obviously splitting hairs legally, that there is a contradiction between their commitment to enforce the Constitution and local laws passed by local politicians.
This leaves a bigger problem, though, in terms of enforcing the enforcers. How do they go about doing that?
Well, this is the great challenge. And what you are seeing, of course, is the fact that in the United States, a lot of these positions are actually political appointees or political offices. So there is a degree to which they can be recalled. We might recall, for example, that in the United States, in California, the governor there was recalled, which led to Governor Schwarzenegger coming in. We've seen that taking place at a lower level. So there is a degree to which individual citizens can take the law back into their own hands by revoking these people's positions. But of course, it does present a hell of a challenge.
And also, if you're in an area where people don't want the gun laws to be enforced, they're certainly not going to start to recall anybody who's governing them.
Absolutely. And this is something that's taking place right across the country. This isn't just an Eastern establishment thing. This is going to run from New York right through to Colorado.
Particularly in the American heartland, where obviously gun ownership is incredibly common and that kind of grassroots opposition to gun law restriction is high. What does this really mean for Washington? Because clearly this isn't a Washington issue. They are saying our way of life means nothing to these politicians. Our interests are not being promoted. What can Washington do? What can the politicians do?
Well, that's a good question. When you have people on the ground who aren't enforcing the law, it does raise the great spectre of what on earth are national politicians meant to do about this. What it does, I think, suggest is that there is a need to take a lead at a national level and to clarify what this position is with regards to the Constitution. All I can assure you, however, is that that isn't going to happen anytime soon, because this administration's only got just less than 3 years left in office, and the Democrats and the Republicans are not in any way gearing up for a fight over the Second Amendment anytime soon.
James, let's move on to a criticism coming from the Saudis, aimed at Barack Obama, or the Obama administration at least, saying that they are being indecisive when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Why on earth are the Saudis piping up now?
Well, why wouldn't they, I guess, is another question. There's an awful lot of speculation about what is going to happen in this part of the world over the next couple of years. For many years, of course, the United States has been a solid ally of various nations in this part of the world, predominantly Saudi Arabia. We have seen over the last couple of years with the Arab Spring and a whole series of movements which are going to raise questions about the intent and direction of US foreign policy in this region. We were speaking earlier in the week about an apparently new secret, or maybe not so secret, US base in Qatar, the idea that the Americans are dovetailing out of Saudi. And now we've seen the former intelligence chief of Saudi Arabia, Prince Tuki al-Faisal, come out and basically mock, effectively, President Obama with regard to his lack of adherence to his red lines with regard to Syria.
Well, his language on that was very strong. I mean, some might say that these criticisms of Obama serve the Saudi interests. They've obviously been particularly affronted by Mr. Obama's refusal to intervene in the Syrian civil war, as I see it, obviously issues on Iran and the nuclear problem. But in terms of these red lines, actually, they have a, some might say they have a point. I mean, he's, he said we've seen several red lines put forward by the president, which went along and became pinkish as time grew and eventually ended up completely white. There will be lots of people in the world who say that's exactly right.
Yeah, and I'd be one of them and have been saying as much for a while, to be quite honest. There's no doubt that President Obama, you know, backed himself into a terrible corner inadvertently, I think, in August 2012, was wriggling his way out of it ever since. And thank goodness for Vladimir Putin for getting him off the hook, arguably, in the last couple of months. But if you're in the Saudi leadership, you're looking around thinking, well, where is our ally, the United States, going? For all this talk about Obama coming in 2008 and resetting various alliances, you know, if you were a key American ally in that part of the world, you didn't want any change. And he's brought change that we can believe in, especially in that part of the world. But it's not change that the Saudis really want to see at all.
To what degree, therefore, are these comments not necessarily directed at the Obama administration for their inaction when it comes to the likes of Syria and also the Israeli-Palestinian question, but also a plea or a warning from Saudi Arabia itself saying, please, just let us know where you are, United States, because we think we're losing you?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, because this gentleman's not in a position of authority at this point, but he's certainly someone who's going to be listened to. There is, I think, a general lack of understanding about where the United States is heading to. In the first term, we heard a lot about pivots to the Pacific, and a lot of people in Europe were concerned about that. We've seen in recent months concerns in the Middle East about where the US is heading. It appears to be heading less toward the Pacific than it was in the first term, but nobody quite seems to know where on earth it is
Iran,
going.
It's heading towards
Iran,
isn't it?
Well, Iran, it's a distinct possibility. And I think you can see a lot of people, John Kerry in particular, looking at trying to secure a peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians, something to do with the Iranians. One wonders whether this is for the long-term national interest or whether it's short-term political gain for individual politicians like John Kerry, for example.
And what about the Saudis themselves? If they were to realign their diplomatic allegiances in the region, who would they go to?
Well, this is one of the great challenges, because what you end up with potentially is a power vacuum. If the Americans move out, as some people are speculating, I think that's overstating the case, but if you do go to that point, who comes in? And the obvious people would be the Russians. And you can see Putin, for example, playing a blinder, I think, this last 6 to 12 months. It's astounding to me that time didn't make him person of the year, because I think he's had such a strong influence in that part of the world, far more so than the Pope has, I think.
You end up with a very strange situation, which has happened with Iran, with the Iranian nuclear deal a couple of weeks ago, that Saudi Arabia and Israel suddenly found themselves shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, we're almost through the looking glass here, aren't we? This idea that where we are now isn't where we were a year ago, and who could imagine where we are going to be a year from now at this point?
Let's wonder where Mayor Bloomberg's going to be a year from now, or where, rather, to the point, his construction projects that he's pushing through crazily are going to be in a year's time. This is obviously legacy building from Bloomberg's point of view. But
yeah,
tell us more.
Quite literally building. It's not unusual for departing mayors of New York to try and put a final stamp upon the great city as they move out. We've seen this in the past. We looked, for example, if we go back in time, we can see how the tennis stadium that the World Series is played at, for example, was part of that. We can see the new Yankee Stadium was part of that. What Mayor Bloomberg is doing now is very much trying to lock in place his great legacy. He's been mayor for 12 years. It seems like he's been mayor forever. Effectively.
Forever, yeah.
And now he's looking at doing a great deal of building places like Staten Island, for example. Those of you who like retail, there looks like there's going to be an outlet mall.
No
on
one
Staten
in New
Island.
York likes retail.
No, absolutely.
It's no one goes shopping in New York.
It's not the place to
That'll
go.
That'll fail dismally.
Exactly. There's reasons to go to Staten Island now instead for the city dump, which will be great. So
they have the enormous wheel happening in Staten Island, and it's going to be very beautiful and very and a long time coming. And to what degree is Bill de Blasio going to be bound by Bloomberg?
Well, what is interesting here, obviously, is we are going to see a new administration coming in the new year. But historically, mayors who have come in and inherited such projects have basically said, OK, fair enough. You know what? This is something that was put in place. We're not going to play silly buggers. We're just going to let it go through. Also, don't forget that the incoming mayor was very much part of the existing team under Bloomberg, and he has actually been well aware a lot of these projects are going to go through. So this is an attempt by Bloomberg to get his stamp in, to put legacy issues in there, and I think there's every reason to think that they will go through.
It's quite cheering for those of us who would like to see more sort of smaller scale and cultural projects going on in New York, because it's one thing to have these incredibly flashy sports stadia and retail complexes and huge skyscrapers, but the Bloomberg administration have been quite good good at actually diverting public funds or committing public funds to, for example, the restoration of the Lowe's King's Theatre, mm-hmm. which has been vacant for a long time, and $50 million to a cultural centre at Hudson Yards, which is a great, I mean, it's an interesting point because you might think that Bloomberg just wanted the kind of big ticket, you know, landscape altering, literally, projects. What do you think that says about him?
No, absolutely. I think what is great about it is he's come in and he's recognised, I think, the true pulse of New York is not just the multimillionaire developers, but everyday New Yorkers who have to live in the city. There's been a fantastic restoration, for example, of the old elevated train surface down there, especially down in the lower part around the Battery area of New York, which I was there relatively recently. So it's a fantastic legacy issue, I think, that Bloomberg has put in place.
Dr. James Boyes, we're going to have to leave it there. Many thanks indeed for being on the show. Great to see you, as always. Dr. James Boyes, US political historian at King's College London.
Coming up, France asks for European assistance in the Central African Republic. We'll ask if more troops will help the humanitarian efforts there.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
You're back with Midori House with Clemency Burton-Hill and Emma Nelson. Next, we head to the Central African Republic, where French intervention in the recent unrest has not had the decisive effect François Hollande might have hoped. Hundreds of people have died since the disbanded Seleka Muslim militia began a series of attacks targeting the Christian population around the capital of Bangui. The Christians have retaliated with equal force.
It's in this context that around 1,600 French troops have been deployed to restore order, along with 6,000 from the African Union. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius met yesterday in Brussels to request more support from Europe. To find out what form this support will take and how it will help the crisis situation, we're joined on the line now by Lewis Mudge, a researcher from the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on the show. Tell us more about what this really means and how sustainable it will be.
Well, I think what both the African Union and the French are finding is that this is proving to be more difficult than once thought. And the basic fact of the matter is we're dealing with a country the size of France. We're dealing with 450 to 500,000 internally displaced. And we're dealing with chaos and anarchy both inside the capital and outside. So the troops that are on the ground are simply not sufficient. The AU troops, while they're higher in number than the French, don't have the supplies that they need, and more has to be done.
Would you argue, therefore, that more troops on the ground, more boots on the ground, are a better idea? We spoke last week to Médecins Sans Frontières, who wrote an open letter to the United Nations saying that, effectively, the UN had abandoned about 100,000 people. They hadn't intervened when people were really in dire need. Is more military intervention needed, or is it more humanitarian here?
Well, it's both. It's both. But you're not going to get the humanitarian intervention that's needed without security. We're dealing with a country that's incredibly unstable. I was driving through these zones a few weeks ago, and you can go from a peaceful situation to having a gun put in your head 5 minutes later. So it's very fluid and it's very unstable. And frankly, the humanitarians that are on the ground now, the NGOs like MSF, are doing a remarkable and incredible job. But the security has to be established for there to be the large-scale humanitarian intervention that's needed. I mean, we are talking about hundreds of thousands of people that need support. And MSF was hitting the nail right on the head when they said the humanitarian response thus far by the UN has simply been unacceptable. We saw this firsthand, our teams on the ground in the north. I was in towns that had been attacked months before and burned to the ground, towns, not villages, and the UN did not even send one sole team up there. So it simply hasn't been acceptable to date.
And what is the reason for that? What degree is the Central African Republic a victim in a way of its own obscurity? I mean, it doesn't grab the headlines in the same way that other African nations do, in conflicts in other African nations do.
No, it doesn't. You're dealing with a country that most Anglophones have a hard time finding on a map if they even know it exists, despite its large size. The Central African Republic has been a victim of coups since it got independence from the French. And this is a country that has very little geostrategic power. It's not very high up on the pecking order. It certainly doesn't get the attention that South Sudan or the Congo would get in terms of international media. But on humanitarian grounds, this is a crisis just as big as anything we're seeing across the globe. And in terms of loss of human life, we think that the world really needs to start paying attention. It has been better as of late. Don't forget, the Seleka took power on March 24th, and we've been trying for months to get people engaged on CAR. The situation in the Central African Republic has gotten worse as of late, and the international community is starting to pay attention. Better late than never.
To what degree do you think that the rest of the European Union is going to be receptive to any French requests? They're seeing mission creep happening in Mali. They're going to be worried about it happening in the Central African Republic.
They are, and it's something we're pushing hard. We're hoping the EU is going to stay engaged. We've seen the UK, both in terms of humanitarian assistance and in terms of some assistance to the African Union troops, start to get a little bit more engaged, start to show some interest. Ironically, the United States is starting to take a real lead on this. Obama's freed up $60 million to the AU force, not a lot of money, but that will go a long way to the AU force already on the ground. And the U.S. administration last week started airlifting Burundian troops from Bujumbura and Dubangi. So perhaps the EU can look to the United States and see them taking the lead, and perhaps that'll encourage them to get a bit more engaged.
Lucy, you mentioned that the CAR has had this history of coup and rebellions ever since it gained independence from France. But to what degree is what we're seeing now, which is this kind of cycle of retaliatory religious killings, anchored in its past, or to what degree is that a new development?
It's a new development. I've been working on this country since 2009, and you know, these two groups, the Christians and the Muslims, have been living together, not without problems. There have always been problems. It's something along the lines of what you see in this band of Africa with the primarily Muslim herders and their cows disturbing the land of the primarily Christian agriculturalists. So this is a problem that you see. But we've never seen violence on this scale. And it's very, very worrying, and this is why we're really hoping for international engagement now, while there is still time and space for reconciliation and mediation, because I was shocked hearing some of the words out of the anti-Balaka, these new armed groups that are rising, these Christian groups. They're saying things that are very worrying, such as we need to exterminate all the Muslims, they're not from here. There is still space for mediation. There is still space for reconciliation. These are groups that have lived together peacefully for a long time. But there needs to be disarmament and there needs to be some type of security established for that to start.
And finally, Lewis, and briefly, if you may, you mentioned at the beginning of this interview that the AU, the African Union, their support just wasn't up to it. Why can't there be more requests for resources from them?
They are requesting both logistic and financial support, and there are other countries that are strongly considering sending troops. But the AU is primarily, this AU force is primarily financed through the EU, and they're only as powerful as the money that's available to them. So it's an African Union force. It'll be African Union troops on the ground besides the French, but it'll be financed through the Western countries, and that finance has to be paid up. So they also need more support. And if it's not troops on the ground, it has to be loosening up the purse strings.
Lewis Mudge from Human Rights Watch, many thanks for coming on the show.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It's time now for us to get a check of the top stories in one part of the world. And today we're heading to the Middle East. Joining us from Jerusalem is our woman over there, Marijke Peters. Thanks very much indeed for joining us, Marijke.
Hi there.
Storms battering the West Bank, both literal and metaphorical. But let's start with the weather, shall we? Really horrendous scenes, particularly in Ramallah and Al-Bir. Tell us more.
It has been incredible. The biggest storm that they've seen in this region for decades. It has a name. She's called Alexa. And basically, she saw a lot of places cut off. Ramallah was like the end of the world. You couldn't get out, you couldn't get in. There was no electricity. The water then went off. And, you know, given that most people here don't seem to have central heating or you know, good systems for keeping warm, it was really a bit of a nightmare for a couple of days. It started to get a bit better. The roads are open again between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and people have started moving and clearing up outside. You know, my window, I can see a lot of people getting involved with moving the snow off the roads, and hopefully that's the end of it.
How often does this kind of weather hit the region? Are you prepared for it?
I think there is often snow, but it's more of a smattering. And what happened this time was a full-on blizzard. I mean, it snowed here pretty much 2 days solid, which left a metre on the ground, the same, you know, across the highest parts of the West Bank. There is now a debate about how well prepared the government, particularly in Israel, was for this. Benjamin Netanyahu is saying that, you know, that they made a fantastic effort and the rescue services were really good at getting people out of their cars when they became stranded and bringing people back on grid. But there are still quite a lot of villages and towns in Israel without electricity. There are fingers being pointed now and questions being raised about, you know, whether they were prepared enough and what they'll do next time if this happens again.
It does beg a belief. I've been in the West Bank every single December for the past 9 years. This is the first December I haven't been there. And normally it's quite balmy, quite warm, with blazing blue skies and sunshine. It just, it's hard to conceive, really. Let's move over to a more political storm, Marijke. People are saying that Israel is opening a de facto jail for African migrants. 450 African asylum seekers being moved to a new detention centre where they'll effectively be held indefinitely without charge. Tell us more about this.
That's right. This was a new detention facility that was opened last week with a lot of fanfare from the Israeli government. It's in the Negev desert, and it's part of a new law that the Israelis have introduced on African migration to the country. Now, these are people who had been in prisons who are now living in this detention centre with slightly different rules. They are locked up at night, but they can leave during the day. They have to check in sort of three times with staff at the centre, and they're not allowed to work. There obviously wasn't enough security there because 150 of them actually left this weekend and are now marching towards Jerusalem in protest at what they see as a very unfair conditions.
This is all part of a new so-called anti-infiltration law, isn't it, Marijke? Which is being flagged up as the Israeli government saying is it's creating a suitable balance between the right of the state of Israel to defend its borders and its obligation to act in a humanitarian manner. How successfully has this balance been struck?
Well, the Israeli government has long been waging a war on African migration. African migrants here are treated extremely badly. And, you know, there's a lot of concern from human rights organisations in Israel about the policy towards them. This new law was designed to hold them less time than was previously the case. But in terms of kind of public relations, you know, this example hasn't been particularly good for the law. What these 150 African migrants are now demanding is that they can meet with the interior minister in Jerusalem and try and get this thing changed. They're saying that they're being locked up, they haven't done anything wrong, and they're going to set up a tent protest outside the Knesset building.
Marijke, just tell us very quickly now about Netanyahu and his private jet. This is, of course, the man who couldn't afford to attend Mandela's funeral. Now he wants a private plane.
That's right. Well, that's actually because the Israeli government have worked out that it's cheaper to buy a plane than to lease one, which is what they've been doing. The question now is, have they got enough cash? They were going to allocate around about $30 million for this jet, which sounds like a huge amount of money to me, but it turns out you can't buy very much for that. This is about how many people he travels with, which is at least 20 when you take into account his wife and his advisors and the journalists he normally has accompanying him. And he also needs to have a bedroom and an office on board this plane, which takes it out of a certain size category. And of course, finally, you know, what with him being the Prime Minister of Israel, he also has to have missile defense systems and all sorts of security on board this plane, which makes it very difficult to find. Apparently, you're talking about $75 million. So we'll see how Bibi gets around from now on.
We'll see if he arrives in a lovely Gulfstream or in a wonky old turboprop. We'll see we'll watch this very closely. Thank you very much indeed, Marijke Peters.
Given that the Saudi prince, though, flies in a plane that cost $500 billion, I think it all looks quite modest.
Maybe you could lend him a quick...
All looks quite modest by comparison.
Maybe you could lease it.
There you go. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll hear about the year that was from our Asia bureau chiefs, and our Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess Watson, pops down to a Cartier retrospective.
It shows that a house of jewellery has a specific style since its very beginning, and it's very distinctive and probably not as well known as for other artists.
But first, here's David Spencer with the world news.
Thank you very much indeed. North Korea has marked the two-year anniversary of the death of former leader Kim Jong-il. Images from Pyongyang showed a hall with ranks of military personnel in front of a huge picture of the late leader. Sat at the front of the ceremony was his son, Kim Jong-un, who inherited the leadership after his death in 2011. A judge in the United States has ruled the mass collection of telephone data by the country's main spy agency is unconstitutional. The operations of the National Security Agency were described as an arbitrary invasion. The leaders of Russia and Ukraine will meet later to discuss possible loans to help ease an economic crisis that has seen huge anti-government protests in Kiev. The demonstrations were sparked after Ukraine rejected an EU trade deal. The UN Secretary General is calling for a ceasefire in Syria's civil war ahead of planned peace talks next month. Ban Ki-moon says the humanitarian crisis around the fighting is getting worse as winter approaches. Britain should consider building new runways at London's Heathrow and Gatwick airports, a government commission has said. The Airport Commission has issued a shortlist of expansion options, saying it would also undertake a further study of another option to build a new airport in the Thames Estuary to the east of London. And in Brazil, construction at the World Cup stadium in the jungle city of Manaus is expected to remain partially shut down again on Tuesday, as officials continue to investigate the death of a worker there on Saturday. Construction was initially shut down after public prosecutors demanded guarantees of workers' safety. Earlier on Monday, some workers stopped working in protest as they demanded safer working conditions. There have now been 5 deaths at stadiums being built for next year's tournament. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks, David Spencer. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24 with Emma Nelson and me, Clemency Burton-Hill. And we head now to Paris, where a retrospective of the jeweller Cartier is currently filling the Grand Palais with a good deal of sparkle. It's the most important exhibition ever to be dedicated to the jewellery house, bringing together 600 of its most important pieces, some of which have never been put on public display.
Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson went along on the opening day of the exhibition, and he then headed to Cartier's flagship store on the Rue de la Paix in the heart of the French capital. There he met Pierre Agnero, Cartier's Director of Image, Style and Heritage.
I think it's very important because it shows the specific aspect of Cartier creation, which is about style. It shows that a house of jewelry has a specific style since its very beginning, and it's very distinctive and probably not as well known as for other artists.
What sort of things are on display?
The number of exhibits is very impressive because there are more than 600 Cartier creations together with 300 documents from our archive and documentation departments. So it makes this exhibition one of a kind. No other exhibition in the 20 last years has happened like that.
What sort of things might we look out for? What to you are some of the highlights of the whole exhibition?
Oh, there are different point of views and different ways of looking at the exhibition, because you have the exhibition is organized in different sections, each of them showing a different aspect of a creation of Cartier. So each of the sections is worth seeing, of course, and looking at. But I think at least there are two important windows. One is dedicated to the tiaras, the first platinum tiaras ever created at the very beginning of the 20th century in what we call the neoclassical style, called now the garland style, and this window is really, really incredible. And there's a second window, which is not to be missed, is a window entirely dedicated to mystery clocks. Mystery clocks are a Cartier invention, and they are called mystery clocks because the hands are like floating in a block of rock crystal without any apparent link between the hands and the movement, and they are really, really chef-d'oeuvre, as we say in French, and not to be missed.
And so royalty have been a big part of Cartier's history, kings and queens who've ordered their tiaras and other ornaments and so on. Who are some of the other icons of Cartier over the decades, do you think?
I think there's a very important point about Cartier, because since the creations show a very daring style, because Cartier has always been very creative in a very specific way, and the creations of Cartier have been adopted by women, especially women, with a very independent and strong character. And I think it's the common point of all these important clients throughout the history of Cartier, and especially at the time of what is called now the Café Society. Café Society stands for a social life, including at the time in the salon, the artists that were welcomed for the very first time in society. And it means that within those circles between Paris, London, Venice, and New York sometimes, I think the creation and the statement of your own character and your own style through jewelry was very, very important. And Cartier was the main supplier to those very important women. Important because they were trendsetters and they opened the doors to the behaviors of the women of today.
And some of those women have a special place in this exhibition. Tell us a little bit about who some of those people were, the really iconic women of the day who've been so important to the brand and perhaps endorsing the brand of Cartier.
Everything starts with queens, of course, and there's a window entirely devoted to Mary of Romania, the Queen of Romania, in the 1910s and 20s. And one of the most important stone exhibited is the blue sapphire of 478 carats that Cartier sold to her, and she was wearing as a pendant. And there's a very important portrait of her of that time, showing her wearing the Cartier jewelry. And then all the way through the exhibition, you have women, for very important women, for each period from the 20s, 30s, 40s until the 70s. Not to be missed, of course, I think Marjorie Mary Weber-Post, very important American client who had incredible collection of Cartier jewelry, but also Daisy Fellows, or also Liz Taylor, the Duchess of Windsor, and of course Grace Kelly, for instance.
Yeah, some very glamorous clients over the years. Have clients' demands changed notably, say, in the last 15, 20 years? Are the sorts of things people are ordering markedly different from perhaps during that Café Society era?
I think the main point today is really the freedom of expression. I think if there's a point to really enhance today and to see as a very distinctive is the freedom that nowadays women do enjoy. And I think that there are a lot of different pieces that are ordered, because effectively those women that we mentioned in the past opened the doors to them today, and the possibilities are total today. And we can have very daring pieces, such as we saw in the exhibition, crocodiles, panthers, as far as figurative jewelry is concerned. But you have also a new kind of femininity expressed. And even if the style and is the same, we produce, for instance, tutti frutti pieces. Tutti frutti stands for, you know, the Indian-inspired jewelry at Cartier, mixing the different colors of stones like emerald, rubies, and sapphire with carved stones. And today we produce that kind of pieces, but in a very different way. The structure of the pieces of jewelry is very subtle, very much articulated, fluid, and probably, I say, because we are not into sociology at that stage, but probably expressing a very serene kind of femininity today.
That was Tom Burgess Watson reporting from Paris. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London, where we turn our attention now to the timeless allure of glamour, what it is, how we define it, and what it represents to different people. What differentiates glamour from glitz? What makes Barack Obama a glamorous and Bill Clinton merely charismatic?
There's no one better than Virginia Postrel to answer all these questions and more. She teaches a special seminar on glamour at the School of Visual Arts in New York. She's also the author of Power of Glamour, Longing and the Art of Visual Persuasion. Our Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to her a little earlier on.
Defining glamour is a tricky thing, and it's one of the things that I try to do in the book. We often think of glamour as some kind of style. If you just wear the right clothes or have shiny furniture, that's glamour. But what I came to realize was that glamour is not a style, it's a form of communication. It's like humor. There's an audience and there's an object, something glamorous. And in the audience's reaction to that object, there's a specific emotion aroused. Instead of amusement, laughter, as in the case of humor, it's a pang of projection and longing. And that pang of projection and longing is how we recognize glamour. But then the other thing I do is I identify the elements that create that pang and that are also always associated with glamour.
And I want to ask, how influential is glamour in our lives? I think it's probably much more than people could imagine, no?
Yes, because once you start thinking about glamour, thinking about what is glamorous to you, what is glamorous to people in different circumstances and places, you start to realize that it is very prevalent. Glamour influences, for example, a lot of people's career choices. They have a glamorous idea of a certain kind of career, and that points them in a direction. Now, obviously, by the time you actually get the job, it's not necessarily glamorous anymore because you've learned all the things that were hidden in the glamour. But glamorous presentations. I'm from a certain generation of journalists, many of whom were influenced by the glamour of the Woodward and Bernstein portrayed in All the President's Men by Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman, this idea that, you know, being a journalist is like speaking truth to power and bringing down the president and all this sort of stuff. And by the way, being a movie star. So that's one thing. People often move to cities they find glamorous. And then there are little things, of course. There's glamour is used a lot in commercial transactions. You know, you see a glamorous pair of shoes or a glamorous car or a glamorous picture of a kitchen, and you think, oh, if only I could have that kitchen, I would have the perfect entertaining life.
One thing that I mean, the book starts already in an amazing way, I have to say, and I would like you to mention the story of Michaela de Prince, which is a perfect example of how glamour influences our lives as well.
It's a wonderful story. Oh, so Michaela de Prince today is a young dancer, professional dancer. She was born in Sierra Leone, and when she was 4 years old, she was living in an orphanage in a refugee camp. Her father had been murdered in the Civil War. Her mother had died of starvation, so she's really in this horrible circumstance. And if that weren't bad enough, of all the little kids in the camp, she was sort of treated the worst, rated the worst. She was called a devil child because she had a slightly rebellious personality, but also because instead of having sort of perfectly beautiful little kid, even brown skin, she had these white patches on her skin, so she wasn't as cute, you know. And one day, a Western dance magazine blew against the fence of the orphanage, and on the cover of the magazine was this beautiful, smiling ballerina. And she had never seen anything like that, anything so beautiful. She tore off that picture, and she kept it. She stored it in her underwear because that was the only private space she had. She didn't have a backpack or a, you know, chest of drawers or anything like that. And every night she would look at it and just dream of being that person that took her out of that world, that terrible world she was in. And she says, you know, I wanted to be just like her. And she also says things like, it saved me. It helped her live another day. And she was fortunate because not too long after this happened, an American couple came to the orphanage, actually to adopt another little girl. But they ended up adopting two, and including her. And she showed this sort of tattered little picture of the ballerina to her new mother. And when she moved back to New Jersey, she started taking dance lessons. And she was very directed because she wanted to be that person. And that is glamour in its sort of most redemptive form. It takes a person out of this horrible, difficult, almost unbearable situation and gives her an imaginative respite. And then it turns out, because things work out for her, it also directs her career toward a very satisfying career. She was very directed, and she was dancing on point at an early age, and she became a professional ballerina a couple years ago.
It's a beautiful story, but I would like to talk now about another chapter of your book where you kind of differentiate between charisma and glamour. I mean, if you can give us some examples of someone who might be charismatic and someone who is glamorous nowadays, for example, or someone who can be both.
The example that I use, you know, that I sort of lead with is a political example, because charisma is very common in politics. You sort of can't be successful in politics without a certain amount of charisma. And what charisma is it's a stage presence. It's a personality quality that makes people want to please you. They want to join your cause. It's, you know, this ineffable quality that is sort of owned by the person. And so, you know, a person, there are lots of politicians who are charismatic, but in recent American political history, Bill Clinton is charisma champ. I mean, he's super charismatic. Glamour is much more unusual in politics because glamour requires mystery and distance, and this discussion actually occurs in the chapter on mystery. And glamour encourages the audience to project their hopes and dreams onto whatever or whoever is glamorous. So if it's a picture of a ballerina, it's, you know, what it would be like to be a ballerina. If it's a politician, it's that person represents whatever I want in the country, whatever I want in a leader. Well, Barack Obama in 2008 was a great example of glamour. I used to say it was God's gift to my glamour project, because people projected onto him all whatever they wanted in a country, in a president, in a world. He didn't have a long political record. We didn't know that much about him. It was just enough to be appealing. And he has a kind of coolness to his personality. And one of his friends during the campaign said, you know, he's an Rorschach test. So charisma is this personal quality. Only a person can be charismatic. A car or house can't be charismatic. A city. Glamour is something that's really more about how the audience perceives that object. And so it doesn't have to be a person. The meaning is in the audience's mind, not in the person. And so you have, if you're a politician, glamour is a huge asset in a campaign because different people have different views, can imagine that you represent them. But it makes it difficult to govern, because when you get in office, you have to disappoint some people, and things are never as beautiful and easy as they are in the glamorous vision. And so charisma is more important in actually being successful.
Virginia Postol there, talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You're listening to Midori House with Clemency Burton-Hill and Emma Nelson. In just a moment, our Asia Bureau Chiefs Fiona Wilson and Aisha Spears will join us in the studio to review the last year on their patches. But first, to get us there, this is Little Dragon and Ritual Union.
Unions got me in trouble again.
That was Ritual Union by Little Dragon. Well, we're fast approaching the end of the show, but before we go, let's welcome two of our star Monocle Bureau chiefs into the studio to review 2013 from their respective patches. Fiona Wilson from Tokyo and Aisha Spears from Hong Kong, welcome back to the studio. Ladies, lovely to have you in London. Well, tell us what's been going on. Quite a busy year in Asia. Should we start with you, Aisha?
It has been a busy year. I think the man of the moment is, in many ways, President Xi Jinping. We've heard a lot about his changing foreign policy. I'm sure Fiona has something to say about how the Japanese are looking at him. But a few months ago in Bali for the APEC summit, President Obama did not show up because he was dealing with domestic issues of handling the debt ceiling, and so Xi Jinping really kind of stole the show. He kind of was talking on the last day. I think people are looking at how he will change China's relation with their neighbours. In many ways, he has bad relations, but getting involved on it, both a soft power and hard power way of making sure China has a bigger role in the region.
Fiona, just building on that of what Aisha has just said and the influence of Xi Jinping, his presence has been very, very strongly felt in Japan this year, hasn't it?
It certainly has. I mean, he's sort of the man of the year in a kind of negative way in Japan, because I think China has just loomed very large. And I mean, I've been talking about it all year, really. And just towards the end of the year, this extraordinary move in November to create the air defense identification zone, long name, but you know, that really threw everyone in Japan. It took people by surprise. Very aggressive move. And it was interesting, it's really into what Aisha's saying about relations with neighbors, because you know, in a single stroke they upset most of their neighbors by doing that. So yeah, that's been a very interesting subject for the end of the year.
The tussle over the Senkaku Islands has been something that we've returned to constantly over the year. That's presumably loomed incredibly large too.
It has. I mean, it just taps into this really tense relationship between Japan and China. And it's a strange one because, you know, everyone knows about these tensions, and it's got worse and worse basically as the year has gone on. But at the same time, there have been discussions about free trade, you know, and that's the reality, is that you're talking about $250 million of trade between these two countries who may not get on diplomatically, but they have to get on economically, and they do.
What do people in Japan genuinely talk about when they are thinking about China? It has dominated the headlines, but does it dominate daily conversation?
I mean, you know, definitely in so many different ways, even from the matter of pollution, that came up a lot in the summer in Japan, because it's obviously a huge issue in China now, but you look at a map and see how close China and Japan are, and the south of Japan, Kyushu, they had monitoring stations up because it got so bad this summer. And I think you're just reminded of the proximity of these countries in every way.
Talk about proximity. Actually, we were talking most recently about the Philippines and how China reacted to that or didn't react to that disaster. Was that a big story for you this year, do you think?
That was a big story. The Spratly Islands is the disputed area between the Philippines and China. There was tension at the APEC summit where I spoke to President Aquino when the typhoon hit the Philippines just recently. Initially, China sent $100,000 worth of aid, which was kind of laughed at by a lot of the surrounding regions. So they then upped that. I think the Philippines has a tricky situation with both China and Hong Kong. There's tensions between Hong Kong and the Philippines following a bus hostage crisis a few years ago. And so I think that with the Philippines growing as a nation, and that, you know, their economy doing better, and I think there's a changing sense of looking at the Filipino diaspora as moving away from this kind of labourer working class into a much more influential middle class and very comfortable to travel and work abroad. I think China and Hong Kong will have to work out how to treat the Filipinos differently as opposed to simply looking down on them.
Some of the stories that you and I have covered over the year have involved the shoulder rubs that occasionally occur between Hong Kong and the mainland. We've done stories, I think, of people sending their children from China to Hong Kong on a two-hour round trip just to get them into the right schools. How much has Xi Jinping and China encroached now in the last 12 months on the daily workings of Hong Kong?
Well, I've only been in Hong Kong for about 8 months, so I can't really assess what's been going on over the last couple of years. But all I do know is that the current chief executive, Sio Ai Lung, is highly unpopular. It's common for the chief executive to be unpopular. That's kind of what happens in that job. But he is very much seen as a puppet of Beijing. I think there's a huge amount of fear that as the Shanghai Free Trade Zone opens up, and that will be a real focus for Beijing, Hong Kong will be forgotten. So I think over the next couple of years, it's an interesting time for Hong Kong, which kind of has a cultural identity problem in the first place, to work out how it can still lead as a financial centre for not only the region, but for also the greater China region.
Talking about financial centres, Fiona, let's talk about one of the big watchwords in the global economy this year, Abenomics.
I know, that's been amazing to watch, hasn't it? Shinzo Abe, I don't think he even invented the term Abenomics, but You know, he came out very aggressively after his election that he was going to really, you know, reignite the Japanese economy. It hasn't quite happened. There was amazing growth at the beginning of the year. Everyone's really watching. The stock market went up absolutely massively. I mean, I think it's difficult for him. There are all sorts of other factors coming in, and it's really being scrutinised. Is his policy, this very aggressive monetary policy, is it working? It's looking quite good for Japan. Definitely the mood is up. You feel like consumer spending is definitely up. Everyone's looking forward to April when the consumption tax rise happens. Is this sort of fragile economy, are the green shoots strong enough to stand against this tax rise?
Fiona, you mentioned there the increase of the introduction of the tax in April next year. What other things can we look forward to in Japan in 2014?
I think the big thing will be what's going to happen with China. Everyone's very excited about how close they are to coming to real confrontation. I don't think so. It's how the US's role is also going to shape up in the region. So I think it's going to be a fascinating year for the news.
And in Hong Kong, I think one of the, on a local level, the pan-democracy movement is gaining strength. There's a big Occupy demonstration coming next year, so we'll be looking at that. I doubt it's going to have any effect because, after all, Hong Kong is in China. We're not going to be getting a democracy, but we'll see who's asking for one. And then on the China level, APEC will be in China next year, so Xi Jinping will be the leader of that, as he kind of was in Bali anyway.
Aisha Spears from our Hong Kong bureau, Fiona Wilson from Tokyo, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer, Aled John, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie McConkie, and to our studio manager, Alex Funnel, too. Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs, presented this week by Daniel Giacopelli. Stay tuned for the briefing. That's airing at midday London time, 7 a.m. if you're listening in New York. Tai Enright and Phil Han will be back behind the microphone to bring you Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 8 a.m. London time. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Clemency Burton-Hill. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. Its dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.